the highest risk the state faces is a lawsuit and a reopening of all of the rural school funding inequality issues.
Debate over extra funds for Kivalina's school. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, flooding in Deering affects the airport.
With those record temperatures comes different events and different issues.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Susan Carney will be the next Supreme Court Justice following Justice Dana Fabe's retirement. Governor Bill Walker announced his appointment of her this afternoon in Anchorage. Carney has a long tenure as a defense attorney with the Office of Public Advocacy in Fairbanks. She'll be only the second woman to serve on the Alaska Supreme Court after Fabe. Despite having never served as a judge before, Walker says she's ready.
You know, there's a number of justices that have moved right from practice into being on the Supreme Court bench. So it's certainly not unprecedented. You take everything in consideration, and I'm sure the Judicial Council took everything in consideration as well. And again, all four came with a unanimous endorsement from the council.
Walker says one of the reasons for his selection of Carney was her experience in dealing with rural Alaska cases. Carney talked about her work with the Office of Children's Services.
I was in Eagle last month. I flew out on a very small plane with one of the OCS social workers to meet with a family that had been involved in a child protection case for a long time, and now they've resolved it. So the kids are home, parents are doing better.
Carney says although she will be serving all of Alaska in her tenure as justice, she will still live in Fairbanks. Carney will take her position as justice shortly after Justice Fabe's retirement on June 1st. The House could begin debate on the bill scaling back tax credits for oil and gas companies as soon as tomorrow. The House Rules Committee released its version of House Bill 247 today. The bill doesn't initially go as far as Governor Bill Walker's proposal to reduce tax incentives, but it would save the state a similar amount to Walker's proposal beginning in 2020. Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says he will seek to amend the bill. The bill gives priority for incentives to companies that hire Alaskans. But Tuck wants to include contractors and subcontractors as well. The Senate Finance Committee today voted against adding $7 million in funding to replace the school in Kivalina. The additional funds were requested by Governor Bill Walker's administration. The committee approved the capital budget for the coming year. The legislature would appropriate $78 million under the plan. The federal government would provide $1.3 billion. But Golovin Democratic Senator Donnie Olson was unsuccessful in adding more money for the school. Olson says the money would settle an education lawsuit known as the Casile case. The plaintiffs argued the legislature didn't treat rural schools equally and the state wasn't fulfilling its obligation.
If there's not a remedy to what goes on, the issue will only grow more complex and expensive. It'll become messy. It'll become difficult to go and handle.
The state initially planned to pay to renovate the school, but instead the state later agreed to pay for a new school in a different location. This would take the school away from the erosion that's affecting Kivalina, which is on a barrier island near Kotzebue. The administration and lawmakers differ over the right amount for the school. The legislature appropriated $43 million last year. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says this satisfies the state's obligation.
For the last decade that we've argued about this issue, the adults have argued about the issue, the children of Kivalina have been in conditions that they should not be in.
The committee passed an amendment proposed by McKinnon saying that the legislature has met its obligation. But the administration says the state should pay $7 million more. State Budget Director Pat Pitney says without the money, the state could be back in court.
The highest risk the state faces is a lawsuit and a reopening of all of the rural school funding inequality issues.
The committee voted 4-1 against Olson's amendment to add the additional Kivalina school money. It voted by the same margin to in favor of McKinnon's amendment, saying the legislature has met its obligation. The capital budget includes $12.5 million to purchase the Wells Fargo Bank building in Anchorage's Spinard neighborhood to serve as a legislative information office. The state faces a potential lawsuit over leaving the downtown LIO. The Northwest Arctic village of Deering declared a disaster this week after a nearby river flooded the only road to the local airport. As KNOM's Emily Russell reports, spring and fall time floods are becoming more common and the community is learning to adapt.
Deering sits on the southern side of Kotzebue Sound at the mouth of the Inmachuk River. The village of about 120 sees planes coming in and out daily, with most going to and from Kotzebue. But Elvin Ayatunguk says that service stopped earlier this week when flooding prevented a plane from landing.
And that plane just circled and took observation of the road and the flats back here and got to report back to Kotzebue.
Ayatunguk is the vice president of Deering's Village IRA. He says an ice jam from the Inmachuk River flooded the road to the airport.
With the high temperatures, everything's just been melting all at once.
2015 and 16, we had very low snow around the state and very warm temperatures.
That's Jeremy Zedek. He's with the state of Alaska's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Operations.
With those record temperatures comes different events and different issues.
Both Deering and the Northwest Arctic Borough issued disaster declarations this week in response to the flooding. Zedek says the borough requested the use of some Department of Transportation equipment to manage the situation. In the meantime, Alvin Ayatunguk has been using some of his own equipment to help people get to and from Deering's airport.
I got an 18-foot long boat here. That's my own personal boat. I gassed it up and practically pushed it in the water and got it going.
Ayatunguk says he's gotten used to the flooding. In fact, he says it happens twice a year now, once in the spring and once in the fall. Deering is working on building a road to the airport that would be outside the river's floodplain. Ayatunguk says it's a consequence of global warming. Just like a lot of other communities in rural Alaska, he says Deering will have to adapt to warmer temperatures, rising sea levels, and eroding landscapes.
We're in the same boat as everybody else, I guess.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Closing arguments in the trial of a Tanana man charged with killing two Alaska State Troopers are scheduled for tomorrow in Fairbanks Superior Court. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, presentations of evidence in the Nathaniel Kangas murder trial ended Wednesday.
Nathaniel Kangas will not testify at his trial for the May 2014 shooting deaths of Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich in the village of Tanana. On day three of the trial Wednesday, Judge Paul Lyle asked the 22-year-old Kangas about the decision not to take the stand.
Your attorney tells me that you have decided not to testify. Is this your voluntary decision?
Yes.
Kangas' defense attorney did not call any witnesses. The prosecution rested after 3 days of testimony. The state is seeking first-degree murder convictions for the May 1st, 2014 shootings, which occurred at the Kangas home. Nathaniel Kangas is charged with shooting the troopers as they attempted to arrest his father, Arvin Kangas, for threatening Tanana's village public safety officer. On Wednesday, the court heard from a medical examiner and forensic firearms expert and viewed an animation of the shootings. Trooper investigator Dave DeCour was asked by District Attorney Greg Olson about any involvement of Kangas' father, Arvin, in the shootings.
In the course of your investigation, was there any evidence that Arvin Kangas told, ordered, or directed Nathaniel Kangas to shoot the two state troopers?
No.
The elder Kangas has already been convicted of evidence tampering for moving the slain troopers' bodies and unholstering their guns. Nathaniel Kangas faces evidence tampering charges additional to the murder charges. A jury will hear closing arguments and receive instructions Friday before beginning deliberations. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Southeast leaders reflect on the passing of Tlingit leader and land rights advocate John Borbridge.
We wanted land. That was the dream I had for our people. Land.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
What does rural health care in Alaska have to do with jobs? A lot, according to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. The regional health care provider is opposing the Donlin gold mine, and a big part of an anti-Donlin resolution the corporation passed last month focuses on the potential for jobs to leave the region if the mine is developed. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
In 2010, a group from YKHC and state officials hopped in a boat to tour the Kuskokwim villages closest to the Donlin site. They wanted to see how the mine could affect the region's health. One of the travelers was Dr. Joseph Klaika, YKHC's corporate medical director.
It was a very interesting trip. A lot of surprising information, not what we thought people would say.
Klaika says villagers were worried about losing people to urban areas if the mine opened. They had already lost some people during the mine's exploration phase between 1996 to 2010, when the mine hired about 300 locals.
Once they had a salary, they moved to Anchorage because it didn't matter where they lived. The mine would pay for them to come in and out for the job.
Klaika says the Health Corporation wants to improve living conditions for the region. It wants to see basic amenities like running water and flush toilets in every village, but improvements like that require local money. Klaika says if the money and the people earning it leave, that has a big impact on the villages.
You leave behind the very young and the very old, who are more of a drain on our system.
But Maverick Carey, president and CEO of the Kuskokwim Corporation, says people have been moving out of the region for years, regardless of whether or not Donlin's camp has been operating.
We've seen a huge increase of people leaving the region and actually moving to the Anchorage area.
TKC owns the surface rights to the mine and serves as the native corporation for 10 villages along the Middle Kuskokwim. Carey says when the mine's exploration phase began about 20 years ago, half of TKC shareholders lived in the region. Last year, that number dropped to a third. TKC doesn't know why they left, but the Native Corporation's priority is to help its shareholders, which it sees the mine doing. Carey says where those shareholders live is up to them.
It's the individual's responsibility to determine where they want their family to live. It's not up to us to dictate to anybody that they should stay in the region.
The Kuskokwim Health Corporation isn't just worried about losing people. It's also concerned about losing subsistence resources to possible mining hazards like mercury and cyanide. Carey with the Kuskokwim Corporation says those fears are unfounded. She says their elders partly chose the Kuskokwim land for its minerals when forming their corporation, and responsibly extracting the minerals can coexist with the subsistence lifestyle.
Responsibly is the key word here, responsibly developing our land that's going to benefit our shareholders over time.
But YKHC board chairman Isai Twitchell says the risk to that land outweigh possible benefits.
Because what we do right now, what we do today, affects the next generation or the generations after that live within our region. They're going to be here when we're long gone.
The mine expects to provide about 3,000 jobs during construction and 1,000 during operation. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Public health offices in Haines and Wrangell are set to close this summer due to state budget cuts. But their services won't disappear completely. Nurses from other southeast towns will occasionally travel to Haines and Wrangell to maintain the safety net their agency aims to provide. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
Both Haines and Wrangell have been without full-time permanent nurses for a few months. Now there's no question, those positions will not be filled. Juneau public health nurse Allison Bramer broke the news to the Haines School Board Tuesday night.
And we have news recently that due to the budget, we will not be able to staff the Haines Public Health Center after July 1st.
We're having to make some difficult decisions.
Southeast Regional Nurse Manager Sarah Hargrave says the state public health system has taken a 25% cut over the past 2 years. Closing the one nurse, one office assistant centers in Haines and Wrangell was just one cost-saving decision.
Well, we aim to continue to outreach and serve the most vulnerable in all of our communities.
Hargrave says they'll continue to provide service through itinerant coverage. That means a nurse from Juneau, Petersburg, or Ketchikan will visit Haines and Wrangell occasionally based on the need. Hargrave describes some of the common services public health provides in Haines.
In the past, we've done a fair number of child health immunizations. We've done sexually transmitted infection care, screening and treatment. We've done family planning services for the Haines community, as well as adult immunizations for flu or tetanus, that type of thing.
Hargrave says the fact that there are other medical providers in Haines and Wrangell didn't impact the decision to close the offices.
We try to act as a safety net so as not to duplicate services provided by other agencies in town. We seek to serve those vulnerable people who may have difficulty accessing other primary care resources.
The budget cut fueled closures go into effect July 1st. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Tlingit leader John Borbridge Jr. died Tuesday. He was a significant player in the campaign for Alaska Native land rights. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Borbridge worked as a teacher and coach in Juneau and Sitka before being drafted in 1965 to lobby for Aboriginal interests in Washington, D.C. He went on to head up the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. In a 2011 address, Borbridge stressed that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was about much more than creating corporations.
It is the story of people who are members of the tribe beginning to understand the extent and nature of their rights and the rights that they have asserted through their predecessors.
In the late 1950s, Tlingits and Haidas won partial compensation from the federal government for the land they lost when the Tongass National Forest was created. Tlingit Haida Central Council President Richard Peterson says Borbridge led the charge to include all tribes in the next congressional battle.
During the original talks for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, you know, there was a lot of desire from other regions to leave Southeast out because they felt we had already been dealt with. And so I know he worked to make sure we were included.
In his address at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Borbridge said he knew tribal members needed more than money.
We wanted land. That was the dream I had for our people. Land. It is cruel to be living in the midst of beautiful land. Land that belonged to the Forest Service. Belong to the state of Alaska or the territory of Alaska.
Once the Claims Act became law, Borbridge chaired the board of directors of Sea Alaska, the regional native corporation for Southeast. Longtime board member Albert Kukesh says Borbridge was impressive, but calming.
I talked to people who he coached at Sheldon Jackson and at Juneau Douglas High School, and he never raised his voice. And that's what happened at the Sea Alaska boardroom, too. He was very persuasive, such a great speaker. When he presented a proposition to the board, it was thorough, it was thought out, he was very articulate.
Borbridge was also the first full-time president of the Tlingit Haida Central Council, hiring staff and building programs beginning in 1967. Current President Peterson says he'll be badly missed.
You know, as any of our elders, that you kind of lose that piece of history, you know, that resource that you can turn to and talk about why we did what we've done and why it's important for what we do today.
There's no word yet about services. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. And by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Matanuska-Susitna Borough schools have close to 19,000 students and are expected to surpass that number by the start of the 2017 fall semester. Despite a funding increase from the borough for the next fiscal year, insurance and benefit increases mean the school district is still in the red. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports.
It's budget time in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, and after a series of public hearings, the Borough Assembly is expected to approve a final version of the spending package this week. Matt Sue, School District Assistant Superintendent Luke Fulp, requested the Borough double its annual 3% increase in education funding. School teachers and principals made similar requests at public hearings in Palmer and Wasilla, and on Monday of this week, the Borough Assembly approved a 6% increase. Luke Fulp.
It was a fairly large ask by the school board. They felt that it was necessitated by the continued growth in enrollment that we've experienced here in the Matsu Valley.
That's good news, but the borough's hike in education funding doesn't make a dent in the $9.5 million the school district needs to get back into the black. Fulp told the assembly in April that the school district is going into the new fiscal year with a $6.1 million deficit. And more recently, there was this news.
During the month of April, we learned of a significant increase to our health insurance costs that we had not previously anticipated. It was a 25% increase that we received a notice on from our health insurance provider, the Public Employee Health Trust. And because of that, we had $3 million of unanticipated expenses added to our budget.
He says employee salaries and benefits take up 85% of the school's budget. The additional insurance costs have pushed the school district further into the red. Fulp says about $6 million of the shortfall will be covered with school district reserves. That leaves a $3.5 million hole. He says the school district is considering reductions in staff, increasing student-teacher ratios in middle and high schools, and reducing part-time instructional coaches at the elementary level.
So in all, it's a combination of about 30 positions that will be reduced from the preliminary budget to make up that $3.5 million. The cuts are across the board, impacting all grade levels. And all schools.
Those measures are expected to get the school district through the 2016-2017 school year. This year, the Matsu School District gained 708 new students. An additional 353 students are expected next year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Recently in Southeast Alaska, eagles, ravens, seals, and sea lions showed up in the sky and sea. They were all waiting for herring. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, after the herring arrive in the thousands to spawn, some of their roe makes its way to Anchorage.
In Sitka, subsistence fishermen placed hemlock trees in the water and herring laid clumps of eggs on the branches. The branches were cut off and some were flown to Anchorage, where at least one Alaska Native Medical Center patient waited with anticipation.
I gotta have some of that.
Probably 5 minutes.
78-year-old Mamie Alexander says if she were home in Ketchikan, she would be eating fish eggs by the plateful. For now, she's happy to have it in a green salad.
Is it good?
No time to talk.
Dr. Gary Ferguson says a change in federal law allows healthcare providers to serve donated traditional foods.
Our goal is to have traditional foods here at the hospital, a regular thing on the menu, and the new menu has herring eggs on the menu.
The patient menu at Alaska Native Medical Center also includes dishes such as pierog or fish pie, salmon soup, smoked salmon, salmon bacon, fiddlehead ferns, and reindeer pot pie. Annie Van of New Napichuk named several dishes she ate while growing up: dried whitefish, fresh seal meat, and muskrat with seal oil. She says it's important for parents to keep feeding traditional foods to their children.
It's more important to eat Eskimo food
let the kids learn how to eat Eskimo food, because one of these years we might not have enough food or enough money to buy food. We have to hunt some food and get them mixed with native food and then white food. That's the best I can say.
Dr. Ferguson says traditional foods offer patients rich nutritional benefits as well as a taste from home. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Were you living in Unalaska in the 1970s or 80s? If so, Christian Scovely is looking for you. KUCB's Zoe Sobel spoke with a Californian who wants to make a book of stories of life in Unalaska.
Scovely came to Unalaska in 2007 and 2008 to work on Deadliest Catch. While there, he became fascinated with stories of life on the Bering Sea and around town. He grew so interested, he went looking for more tales.
And I couldn't find any recorded history back from the 70s and 80s in Dutch Harbor, back when crab was king. And so I thought that there was no book about it, that I would take on the challenge and write a book about it myself.
And he's looking for stories from everyone.
I want to talk to the people who may think that their life there was insignificant, the bartenders, the law enforcement people, the people who worked in the hotels or the processing plant workers.
People are growing older, and he doesn't want those stories to go untold. That's what happened to his grandfather.
I think about my grandfather, who was a butcher in South Dakota, in a small town of maybe 100 people, and nobody thought to ask him what he did. And it makes me sad that I don't have a record of my grandfather. And if I can do that for somebody else, it would make me happy.
If you have a story that you want to tell, you can contact Scovely at storiesfromdutch@gmail.com. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Nome, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Emily Files in Haines, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities. Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. The Business Administration Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.